The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Tell you of an ancient simile, a parable that comes from the Buddha, that I think is kind of evocative, or if you care to, you can kind of apply it maybe to your life and see if there's some application. And to begin it, I'll just tell a little bit modern story, which is not a kind of something I know much about, so maybe I don't get the facts accurate. But a person goes into a bar, and this is not a joke. A person goes into a bar, and just to get out of the heat or something, and not to drink, knows better than to drink alcohol. But the bars, the people who run it, they're so thoughtful and generous, they have all these salted crackers and stuff on the counter for free. Just please help yourself. So the person starts eating those and gets really thirsty and so wants to drink. And so he's in a bar and gets really thirsty, and well, just a little beer would be nice. So that goes the first one, and that feels nice. Gets a second one and feels that's really nice. And then notices other people are drinking whiskey. Oh, might as well. And so the story goes. But the bait, the hook, was those, you know, was maybe those salt crackers. So this kind of idea of there being bait that catches us, and then we start pursuing the particular thing, and we get intoxicated, whether it's literal intoxication with alcohol or something, or intoxicated with other things that we can get caught up in. This was going on 2,500 years ago, probably more, but certainly at the time of the Buddha. And so this simile, the story, kind of is built on this idea that there's bait and there's traps, and you get intoxicated, and then there's traps, and you get caught. And it starts with a story of a herd of deer and a hunter who wants to catch the deer. And so the deer are in the terrain of this hunter, and they're just happily going about their business. And the hunter puts out bait and the various food items that if the deer eat them, apparently back then they had ideas of intoxicating the deer to kind of weaken them or lower the guard or something. So they'd eat this intoxicating piece of food or something, and then it would be easy for the hunter to come and catch these intoxicated deer. And so one herd got completely caught, carted off wherever deer go, when they get carted off. So, but there was a second deer nearby who watched this happen. And they saw that the hunter would put out this bait. So they decided they weren't going to stay in that territory. They decided they would go far away into kind of the wilderness and just really kind of just not live in the lush area with lots of food, but live far away from the danger of the bait, the hunter. And just kind of eat kind of a little bit the weeds that were there, the dry, old kind of shriveled plants that were there, and just kind of manage, you know, in this kind of renunciant way, far away. But sometimes the dry season got really poor, the pickings in this area, and so they'd come back to where the pickings were good. And then they would really be happy to be back, and they would kind of eat a lot, and they would kind of not notice the bait. And sure enough, they ate the bait and they started getting intoxicated, and then the hunter would somehow catch them. But there was a third herd of deer, and they saw all this. And they said, well, we're not going to just casually walk around and eat the bait and get caught. We're not going to go run away and then rebound back at some point and gorge and not pay attention. We're going to live right here in the midst of the hunter's land, but we're going to find ourselves a hiding place. So, and then we're going to come out of our hiding place when it seems safe, And we're going to be really mindful and careful about what we eat. And we're going to kind of check out and avoid the bait and eat other things. And so the hunter sees this, that none of the deer are getting caught. They're not eating his bait. So the hunter has a plan. He puts out lots of traps. Apparently, the way the text talks about it, really big, big traps with the bait inside, but lots of them. And it wasn't clear from the story whether he catches them in the traps, but somehow or other, because he has so many traps, maybe he sees where they can kind of maybe nibble the bait and get away before the trap gets to them or something. The traps somehow give evidence of where they're hiding. So then he kind of just marshals his forces, the hunter, and just goes to the hiding place and catches them. So the idea of staying in Mara's, in the hunter's territory and hiding somehow, that didn't work either. So there's a fourth herd of deer. And the fourth herd of deer see all this that had preceded, and they decide, well, the only way that what we'll do is we're going to go to a place where the hunter can never go. And apparently the place is somehow like a hiding place, something, but some place where Mara can never go. And then the hunter comes along and sees that the deer aren't eating his things and aren't getting caught, and he understands that he can't find them because they go someplace where he can't go. But it occurs to him that he could scare them. But he says, if I scare them, then they're going to get all excited and yell alarm, and all the deer in the forest are going to run away, and there won't be any for me anymore. So I'm going to leave them alone. So he leaves that fourth deer alone, and they're safe. So the Buddha tells a story, simile, and then he's going to explain the simile. And first he says that the hunter is Mara, M-A-R-A. And Mara is kind of, little bit looks like the Buddhist devil. But it's in many of these texts, it's just a simile. It's just a kind of analogy for, or metaphor for something. And it's a metaphor for being caught in the world of sense desires, whatever sense desires there are, and being intoxicated by it all. And so that's what Mara wants to catch people. That's what Mara's job description is, to get everyone intoxicated so they can all get under the sway and power of Mara. So the first herd of deer are those, he actually talks about people are spiritual seekers who just live in the sensual realm where there's, you know, every possible sense, like there is right here in this local area, right? You can't, there's bars down the street, there's, you know, there's iPhones to buy, there's websites to go to. You know, there's food to get. There's all kinds of things to be intoxicated with or caught by. And so the first group of seekers just lives in that realm, and they don't pay attention, and they just like look at the billboards, and we better go to Best Buy. And pretty soon they're all excited and lost in their kind of world, and you know, and pretty soon they're lost to Mara, lost to that intoxicating world of desires and wants and things and all that. So much for them. So there's another group of seekers, spiritual seekers, who notices those people, notice that didn't work to stay in that realm. So they decide to just get out of this sensual world, to renounce, total renunciation, be ascetics, go live in the wilderness, completely, you know, shun anything to do with, sense pleasures whatsoever. And they're successful for a while, but sooner or later, there's a rebound. There's a pendulum swings, and they can keep it. They can, you know, they use their strength of will to keep away for a while, but at some point they come back. They have to come back, and then and suddenly they see all the stuff. Wow, candy, Starbucks, hot dog, you know. And so they like go in there, and you know, I had a friend who was a meditation teacher, a very good friend, and we were teaching retreat together. And usually teachers live at the retreat center during the retreat, but for that retreat, he was living off campus. And so he would come a little bit later in the morning than the rest of us. And one morning, he stopped at Starbucks and had a double espresso or something, you know. And then it was his job to come back to the retreat center, retreat, and lead a guided meditation. And I was sitting next to him. And I don't know, halfway through it, I kind of leaned over and tapped him on the knee and said, you know, I think you better slow down. Because he was like racing through the guided meditation. So, you know, he had fallen into Mara's grips, caught by Starbucks, right? So anyway, so they go off for a long time. And one of the nice things about, not so nice things about people who practice avoidance, just radical avoidance of, you know, just not going to get close that way and kind of shun it and pull back, have aversion and fear, and out of fear, the text talks about having fear pulling back, is it can rebound. Our will can weaken, and then suddenly we find ourselves kind of like not even noticing we're back in it. We're just kind of like, oh, and then we're, and then sometimes it's even stronger than it was before, the desires. So there's some seekers who do that, and so there's a third group of seekers who notice the first two. That didn't work. So they decide that they're going to hide somehow, and they're going to be very mindful in the world of sense desires and live in that world and just partake with just what they need, just enough food, just enough coffee, whatever you need. Just, you know, be very mindful and careful. And then they're going to hide and not be caught by all the billboards, not be caught by whatever people get caught by. Be, you know, very careful how they live. And but that doesn't really work either. And for them, the way the Buddha describes it, their bait that they get hooked into and then get intoxicated by and then get caught by Mara is religious philosophy, is grand ideas of the religious life, grand ideas of life and death and the cosmos and the universe and the nature of all things. So I think it's very interesting. The Buddha chose that to be... you know, the hook. So they were successful in avoiding kind of the usual sense desires, but there was a different kind of desire, different kind of intoxication in religious ideas. And that's certainly possible. And after I practiced my long retreats in Asia, I came back to America and I was talking to one of my Buddhist teachers that I had before I went to Asia. And I was kind of a little bit in an altered state because, you know, I'd been sitting mostly on monasteries for a long period of time. It's all I did, just meditate. And it was great. And my world was reduced to meditation and meditation experiences. And I became a little bit of intoxicated by it all. Like, this is so great, and everyone should do this. And I remember kind of being all excited about my meditation experience and talking to my teacher about my meditation experience. And at some point, he stopped me and looked at me and said, "Gil, talking to you is like talking to an addict." So careful with religious ideas and philosophies and getting caught by that and enamored by it. And it's another way of getting caught. And so then we come to the fourth herd. And they see all that goes on before them. It's kind of nice that you learn from others. You pay attention, you know, and say, oh, that didn't work for those people, so maybe I won't try that. I won't have the saltines in the bar. They figure out, we have to go to some place where Mara can never find us. We're safe and can't be seen by Mara, can't be seen by temptation. So where is it that Mara cannot see us? Where is it that the forces of temptation cannot find us? There's no foothold, there's no hooks. Maybe there's hooks, but there's no fish to be caught. And so the Buddha then says that, well, for those, what they found was a deep meditation practice. A certain kind of, he describes, that a joy and happiness, peace, well-being of meditation practice. A kind of well-being where we're feeling whole, contented, safe, kind of like fulfilled. That the deep meditation has a feeling of being fulfilled. That often feels very meaningful, very nice. And he said, if you there, that place, Mara can't find you. Mara can't put out a trap, can't do all kinds of tricky things to find where you are. There's something about the mind, the heart, in deeper meditation that's very, very fulfilling. And interestingly, in other places, the Buddha said that one of the ways, one of the really, what he felt, I think what he pointed to, one of the important means for overcoming really strong desire, like sensual desire of all kinds, which are very powerful for some people. It's one of the strongest addictions that many people have. One of the strong ways to do that is not through an act of will, not through avoiding it all this, not, you know, though certainly can serve and help, but is in fact to develop through meditation a sense of feeling fulfilled, a sense of feeling kind of satisfied and whole, contented, peaceful, a sense of well-being. And that can help loosen the grip of desire, because part of the reason why we're caught by Mara, caught by the bait of the world, is often because we feel inadequate, we feel not whole, we feel something's lacking, we feel dissatisfied, we feel lonely, we go for the refrigerator and eat, that we feel something is kind of off. And meditation practice is one of the ways to kind of iron out the creases, or some of the ways to fill in the holes of who we are, or to somehow pull out the thorns that are keeping us kind of irritated and anxious and annoyed or something, where we want something to satisfy us, we want something to relieve our difficulty. And so we look for sensual desires or the sense worlds or philosophies or things in the world to get addicted to, caught by and excited by and hold on to. And so one of the functions of deep meditation practice is to provide a very an alternative way of being that's different. And what's interesting about this approach is it's not an approach of mindfulness. The mindful deer were the second ones. The third ones. They started to stay in this world. They tried to be really mindful, and mindfulness could take care of it all. But it didn't, because Mara could find you in your hiding place. So to go to a place where Mara can't, it isn't like Mara can't find you. The text says, the place where Mara cannot see you, you become invisible to Mara while you're in the middle of the world. So it's not a leaving the world behind, but somehow becoming invisible to the temptations, the gravitational pull of saltine crackers in the bar can't find you. So you know you can't get pulled towards it. So this experience of meditation practice. But it's not just mindfulness practice, which is very, that's what we teach here, it's very effective. But there's one step further, and that is to develop the meditation more than just be mindful, but to develop it with some concentration. The concentration is what can almost physically make us feel whole and settled. And to be concentrated requires to learn about the mind well enough to know how to leave alone or let go of the distractions that would come in our mind, the thinking we have. And so it takes some work sometimes, but that's kind of a little bit the dedication that meditation can be about, that yes, I'm not going to get distracted. I'm not going to let my mind jump around and go after everything. Because a distracted mind that jumps after all its distractions is the very mind that can not pay attention to notice when the bait comes along. And we jump to that next debate, and we don't even know that we've kind of been hooked in before, you know, some days go by or some time goes by, or until, you know, things are so uncomfortable, we've overeaten. You know, we eat and eat and eat, and then, oh, why did I eat so much? After you're full and gorged, and then there's wisdom. So the sense of well-being being settled. So the ways in which is one of the ways the Buddha talked about becoming free of Mara. There's a different story around Mara as well that has to tell you, because I think it makes an interesting point. And that is the Buddha used the analogy of crossing the Ganges. Back then in ancient India, there were no bridges. So to cross a big river like the Ganges, a farmer with cows, with a herd of cows, had to find some place where the river was shallow enough that the cattle could cross. And if the farmer didn't find that and put the herd in a place where the river was deep, all the cattle will be washed away and die. But if you find the shallow place, then they can manage to get across the river to the other side. Same way, in this simile, the Buddha said, Mara's realm, the world of Mara, is the river. And you need to find a way across. And if you go across where it's too deep for you, you'll get swept away. But if you go where it's shallow, then you can find your way. And what I like about this simile is that the idea is you still plunge into the realm of Mara's realm. Mara's stream is a stream of desire and sensual pleasures, which is pretty much everything that the world is about, at least in the Buddhist the way Buddhists understand it, that describe it. And in this analogy, people still plunge into the river of sensual world, this world that we live in. They're not avoiding it. There's a plunging in. But you have to plunge in where it's safe. So you create some level of safety so you can get through it to the other side. So one of the ways to create a safe fording of the river and live in this world so that you don't kind of get swept away is to live by the precepts. Live by ethical guidelines. They're meant to be a protection. So if you don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't engage in sexual misconduct, and don't intoxicate yourself, you're much more less likely to get swept up and caught by behavior that somehow intoxicate or infatuate the mind, or where you're not in control. And so there's these guidelines. Here's how you stay in control and you stay where it's shallow and safe to go across. And there's other things to do, practices to do, there are approaches to do that help make the path, the fording safe. The other one is the Eightfold Path. If you kind of use the Eightfold Path as an orientation that the Buddhism offers, that also provides kind of a way to get across. And the other way is to practice mindfulness. Which means, yes, we're going to live in this world, but we have to pay a lot of attention. We have to really notice the tricks of the mind. What goes on inside of us? How desires work for us? How fear works for us? How, deprivation. The forces that, if you practice deprivation, you have to be wise about what that does to you. But what is it to live in this world, to cross this world, not to avoid it, but also not be swept away by all this? And so here, so the Buddha offers these variety of things that support us and help us to live in this world, in this realm, not to avoid it, but live it so that Mara can't find us, live it so we can cross the stream of desire to get to the other side where it is safe. This is this was apparently useful teachings for people 2,500 years ago. Do you think it's useful for nowadays? Or is there an app you can use? So you don't have to bother with meditation or ethics or the Eightfold Path or mindfulness, because a map app. That'll show you how to find your way. Safely. I think it's still relevant. So what do you think? You think that these similes, analogies, and what they're pointing to has any relevance for your lives? They speak to something that you could relate to? I'd love it to hear from some of you if this seems relevant. Please, yes. And if you could say your name first, that would be nice, with the mic, so everyone can hear.
Hello, my name is Rahman. This is my first time here with this group. So, the story reminds me of a phrase, to be in the world but not of it. Nice. Just reminded me of that.
Yeah, it does. It's a great phrase. And how do you understand that?
That's a great question. I think it comes through mindfulness of how we are expected to live in a sense through our limitations, and being mindful of a lot of the assumptions that we make about what we're capable of doing on a day-to-day basis. And being able to see outside of that box.
Nice. So being aware of our limitations means kind of accepting them, but not be pushed around by them or have self-pity for them or something, but be wise about them. And our assumptions means to live in the world, but again, not be caught by the assumptions, but to see what they are and be wise about those as well. Those are great, great answers.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My name's Liza, and it's my first time here, too. But I was thinking about the deer. The second deer were kind of externally focused, right? They were really focused on the hunter and being careful.
Uh-huh.
And the fourth deer were much more internally motivated, you know, less reactive in that sense, right? Because they were focusing on sort of not so much avoiding the hunter, but changing how they were in the field. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Nice. So they changed themselves so they became invisible to the hunter.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because mindfulness is sort of both, right? It's
uh-huh.
internal and external,
yeah.
right? But in the story, mm-hmm. you know, the second deer seemed, I could relate to them, right? Because they were pretty much focused on staying safe
uh-huh.
and not so much, it's just more externally focused, uh-huh. I think.
I think it's a great perception about the observation about the story. So without any, if you don't change ourselves, and you're always protecting yourselves against the world, we're going to be busy for a long time. While people are thinking, Don, could you push that button down a couple of more degrees? It's a little bit too cold for me. You push it up, the up button. Thank you.
Elijah, was that your name?
No, it's Liza.
Liza, oh, okay. You kind of touched on something a little bit. You're talking about fording through the shallow part of the river where it's safe. And I guess I'm wondering, when can you make an argument that you should jump into where it's not so safe? I mean, there's the expression, I'm in over my head.
Usually it's not a good idea.
Well, I guess I'm wondering where taking a chance on something where you might be in over your head, but doing it anyway because I'm struggling with the idea of playing it safe
yeah.
in life
uh-huh.
and whether that indeed can be a limitation, and there might be times when you do need to
take a risk.
Take a risk, yeah.
Yeah, but maybe taking a risk and being, being in deep water when you can't swim are two different things. There's a lovely quote that I like that it says something like, a boat is safe in the harbor, but that's not what boats were built for. So if you know, we're not really, if we only make ourselves safe, is a pretty truncated, limited life. I think important is to have the willingness, the ability to take some risks, but then to be wise about it. So can you think of a situation where, in your language, being over your head, having water, how do you say it? What's the expression?
In over your head?
In over your head.
Yeah.
Have you had experiences in your life where you felt that you were in over your head, but it turned out well, you were glad you did it?
Yes.
What are some examples that you want to share?
Well, I can think of a something right now. There is a work project, a great opportunity for me, and I have never done anything like that before. It's way bigger than anything I've ever done. And I feel like I need to do it, that I have to take that risk. I have to get into deep waters and just swim as much as I can and hope I come out on the other side of it. But for me, I can't not do it.
Great. So if you succeed, then you weren't over your head in water. But if you don't succeed, we know that there was too much for you.
Right.
And hopefully the consequences of failing are not too dire.
I don't drown. Hope I don't drown.
I hope you don't drown.
Yeah.
Now, have you ever been over your head in water, and it was really not a good idea?
Oh, yeah.
That's also happened.
Yes.
So hopefully you have enough wisdom that to have some sense, some intuition of when it feels like you're over your head in the water and it's okay, and it's worth the risk, and some when it's not. And for some people, the consequences of going in over their head is really not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Over here.
Hi, I'm Keith. I think a difference that I picked up in the whole conversation just now about being in over your head is that I think there's a difference between, like, risk that's based off of comfort and risk that's based off of, like, actual safety,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, there's some things that you might do that are just, like, just straight up dangerous.
Yeah.
And then there's other things where it just might not be comfortable and where kind of pushing yourself would be worthwhile.
Yeah.
So I think there's a distinction there because, taking on that new work project is great. You know, I think that pushing ourselves in that kind of a way outside of our normal comfort zone, trying something that maybe we haven't tried before, I think those things can be good. But, you know, if you're going into the raging riptide or something, maybe that's not such a good idea. So I think there's a distinction that can be drawn there.
Great, thank you. And then I saw Trudy's hand in the back. You still want to say something, Trudy?
Oh, sure.
I was thinking the similes for me are like phases of my life where I've used different distractions, different hiding, different ways to hide, different intoxications. You know, being intoxicated with dressing well, being intoxicated with being more and more educated, you know, another degree here and another degree there, and my life will be exactly the way I want it. And ignoring the simple solution of experiencing what I'm experiencing instead of running away from it.
Nice. Great, thank you. Up here, no. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Jacob. So when you were telling the story about the deer that were being mindful and they were being choosy about what to eat, I was kind of rooting for those deer. And I was hoping they were going to survive, and I was disappointed that they all died. But I like what you said about the distinction between the deer that were just mindful in the world versus those that were mindful plus meditation, essentially. And I'm intrigued by the idea of being invisible to Mara. It's kind of a curious and fun concept, being invisible to temptation. So I'm trying to understand why, because I like the idea that mindfulness is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. I like the idea that daily meditation practice adds something. But I'd love to hear maybe a little bit more about why, how we might conceptualize that the meditation practice might make us invisible to temptation. For example, yeah. Is it that if we sit and we're just by ourselves meditating and then we're still happy 20 minutes later and we haven't gotten a new iPhone or a new big screen TV, is it that then we have an insight or it feels more true that we can, without gaining anything new, that then we're sufficient and we're whole? Or is it that if we let our mind wander and then we come back, we realize we don't have to be attached to chasing after things and we can just let things happen? I'd love to hear more about your conceptualization of how does a meditation practice give us this invisibility to Mara? Because it sounds very powerful.
The first thing you said is right to the point, that if you have a sense of happiness and well-being coming out of meditation or calm, feeling fulfilled or feeling contented, that contentment, you're not discontented. And often we want something if we're discontented. So it's a little bit like, maybe, I don't know if this is the best analogy, but having a really good big meal and feeling full and contented. And then they say, well, actually, that was a good meal, yes, but we have the absolute best entree that was ever made by the best chef on the planet. And it's just, you're feel already full, and the temptation is great. I mean, this is supposed to be the best food ever, but you feel content, so you're less, not so interested. It's okay. I don't have to do it. So I don't know if that was the best way of describing it, but the idea that sometimes we can be conventionally contented. We've had our fill, so we don't want any more of something. So meditation is a wonderful way to have your fill without needing to consume anything, buy anything, get anything. And some people might feel like it's not worth it. That means that seems kind of strange, to just sit and get peaceful and contented. You're supposed to be contented by getting something or accomplishing something, so it can't really count, And some people who want to have things, want to have relationships, want to have money, want to have all kinds of stuff, are actually frightened and repulsed by the idea of sitting and becoming contented and fulfilled with nothing but your own breath. And, no, that doesn't count. That's not real. That's frightening or something. And so maybe it is. But it's a wonderful thing to discover how to be happy for no reason at all.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
So up in the front here.
Thanks. I'm Gus. So as I was thinking about this, it seemed to me that it's basically maybe your thoughts on this. It's a question sort of discontent and content, and that maybe mindfulness helps you be aware of discontent so that you can do something different, and that meditation helps you build content. Being content.
Beautiful. Right? Very nice. Very nice. Yes. And mindfulness, once you're content, mindfulness can help you stay contented. So I've been told that, there's lots of the world, a lot about the world I don't know. Maybe I've been one of those guys who goes off into the wilderness and doesn't really haven't entered the stream so deeply. So like one of the streams I haven't entered into is TV. So maybe I missed something, a very important part of my formative growth as a spiritual person by avoiding TV for 40 years. But I have heard that that just as there was Mara in the time of the Buddha, Mara still exists. And the place to find Mara, apparently, is in the TV show Doctor Who. And that some of the episodes of Doctor Who are using the image, the idea of Mara, and Mara's armies, Mara's servants. The writers of the script very explicitly are using this, but I guess you wouldn't know that if you didn't know the stories. So Mara is still here. I can't tell you which episodes, but Mara's not far away. You know about Mara and Doctor Who? Oh, no, I thought you were going to say something. Anybody know the connection? No? Okay. Well, I'm not recommending you go check out Doctor Who, but but just letting you know that. And if you don't find it, if you do watch Doctor Who, you don't find Mara, you're guaranteed to find Mara in the commercials. So watch out for those commercials. Anyway, thank you very much for this evening and for meditating.